Okay, with that, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Hollis Whitson. My attorney registration number is 32911. I'm here representing Michael Garrett, who is incarcerated, serving a life sentence for this first-degree murder case. His uncle wanted to attend today, and the weather kept him away. But I wanted to let the court know that he was going to be here. The court's probably well aware that I rarely seek oral argument. And I always feel like when I do, I should let the court know why. And the reason that I requested oral argument in this case is that the integrity of the screening function in a Rule 35C. The reality is that since I've been in practice, well before the statutes of limitations and rules like Rule 35C and the federal laws, the issue has come again and again to the criminal justice system, who screens the applications. And in the old days, letters could get a public defender appointed, and there'd be a letter, and suddenly there was a court case opened on a letter. So to fast forward to the present, where we find ourselves today, we have rules. We have Rule 35C, and these kind of rules represent hours of debate and discussion by jurists and practitioners about how best to achieve the dual goals of paying attention to claims that should not be summarily dismissed, and paying attention to cases in which they need to be heard. This is an exceptionally important case. This is a first-degree murder case in which the indigent defendant is serving life. So in the Rule 35C, particularly after the 2004 amendments to it, the grand compromise was struck so that the court would and could summarily dismiss petitions, but only if certain functions were fulfilled, and primary among them is the screening function. And almost every requirement in 35C and the cases before it that it stands for were not met in this case. And I cast no blame. There's no blame to be cast. These are very busy district court judges. But when the district court doesn't appoint counsel in a case like this and doesn't provide that screening function through counsel, frankly, where as required for in the rule, to send it to, in the first instance, indigent defense, the public defender, or ADC if appropriate, the rule has some very specific...
Does the rule require in each and every instance of an indigent defendant that the matter be sent to either the public defender or appoint alternate defense counsel?
Oh, no, sir. And we don't want that. That's what was wrong with the old system. A letter would get sent over, and these public defender offices, they'd have an attorney with 600 cases, and you'd open the files, and half of them were letters. You don't want that at all. The court's supposed to review it, and that's in the first instance, and see if it raises, and the examples in the rule are examples. It says they should consider these things. They're supposed to see if it has factual or legal grounds for relief at all. Does it state legal grounds that are not meritorious? I used to get them that literally said, I have a right, I remember one, it wasn't mine, it was one of my attorneys, I have a right to a male attorney. That does not state a legal ground. Factual grounds that even if they were true didn't entitle the party to relief. But in a case like this, these are classic claims that if true would entitle people or this individual, Mr. Garrett, to relief. They're claims about whether the attorney investigated. They're claims about waiver of jury trial is a particularly troubling one, troubling from the perspective that it's meritorious. Venue issues, jury wheel issues. These are the types of claims that you have to have an evidentiary hearing to resolve. You can't say the attorney's failure to raise various conflicts with the court. Even the state's response here, saying, well, this is a strategy call. Well, that's a classic evidentiary hearing. You have an evidentiary hearing, usually the state calls the attorney, and you find out what was strategy, what wasn't, what was going on. The client's going to live with the fact he's just waived attorney-client privilege, so the attorney gets on the stand. District Court, yes, sir.
Your observations about the structural anomalies of this particular case, I think, are sound. If looking back on it, if counsel were to have been appointed at some time, ideally would have been at the trial stage and not on appeal following the summary denial of this motion. And in some ways, Mr. Garrett is a victim of his own exuberance, because this motion is full of allegations, and they're not necessarily easy to sort out. Your brief argues some, but not all, of the allegations that he raised. And so what would be helpful to me would be for you to start with the claim that you believe is the one that most strongly presents potential merit, one that in your view really did require a hearing, and let's go from there rather than trying to take them all at once.
I appreciate that, and I'm heartened by the court's empathy with the position of appellate counsel when we're struggling with brief limits, 15-minute, you know, this is not the forum, and yet so many resources go into the screening function that should have been performed elsewhere. I guess that I don't know if it narrows it much, and first let me say briefly, of course, we don't waive any of the claims. I think I said in my brief we carry them all forward, stated adequately by me or not, and I certainly want to do that today, and by mentioning one, I don't want to waive any of them.
You don't waive them by not mentioning any of them in oral argument.
I'm sure.
But what about not mentioning them in your brief?
Well, I hope I did mention them. I hope I did mention them all in my brief. I certainly intended to and tried to best I could. Again, without the investigation and the types of resources that are provided when the screening functions proper. But Judge Russell, your question, I suppose, could be answered by the biggest one is the ineffective assistance of counsel.
And because the claims of trial error really are going to fall under Rules 35C, 3, 6, and 7. Is that correct?
Many are, but again, it's very hard to tell because of not only the summary way in which this court had to address some of the claims on appeal. If you look at the end of the court's opinion, it's a list. And so when the post-conviction court says, well, claims of abuse of discretion were addressed on appeal, it's kind of broad.
Hard to know.
The opinion, for example, the opinion doesn't mention the claim about the specifically the claim about the pro se motion to waive jury trial.
But even if for the sake of argument that hadn't been raised, it's one that could have been raised, and so it's necessarily gone.
No, I don't think actually that one could have been raised on direct appeal, because, and I think to continue to move towards the answer to the first question, I think that's a big claim. I think the waiver of the jury trial is a really big claim, and it couldn't have been raised on direct appeal, because the issue is whether or not the attorney was ineffective in not conveying that to the court.
Didn't you claim in your brief, though, that was a personal fundamental right of the defendants? And why couldn't it have been raised on appeal if there was in the record his request to waive the jury trial?
The claim was that the court should have paid attention to his pro se motion. But this court and the district court have said no, they didn't have to, i.e., the attorney would have had to bring forth that claim.
That leaves us with a residual ineffective assistance argument.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we're not, they couldn't have been raised. The issue about why didn't the attorney bring it forth? Did the client, the attorney may have testified at the evidentiary hearing, well, the client never said that to me.
Let's look then at that particular claim and look at Mr. Garrett's allegations. The tricky thing, of course, about this allegation is that in order to actually effect a waiver of the right to jury trial, one would have needed the prosecution's consent.
That's one of the three ways it could have been waived. I think, yes.
I mean,
that would have been
Isn't it a necessary ingredient to have achieved a waiver of the right to a jury in this case?
No, I think there's two other ways it could have happened, but they were much less likely. The consent, yes, would be the easiest thing. If the prosecution said, sure.
The allegations.
The second one, I'm sorry.
Do Mr. Garrett's allegations support a reasonable inference that the prosecution would have waived?
I don't know why that, you know, I have a first-degree murder case I'm briefing right now where the prosecutor agreed to waive jury. I think it does happen. I think prosecutors do waive jury. So I think, I really don't know what they would have done. Nor do I think it may not be sufficient just to remand to ask them. I mean, I think that that's the type of thing that you need to have an evidentiary hearing for and have testimony about. It's not going to be simple enough to call up the prosecutor and say, can you file a piece of paper? I think it needs an evidentiary hearing. But let me explain why I said that's only one of the three ways. I think in the there's been recent litigation about the standards, which aren't at issue in this case, but there's an opening in the McKeel opinion that if due process or the right to a fair and impartial jury might have been violated, there's an argument. I think in my brief, I also said that it's possibly an unconstitutional statute. I mean, there's challenges. So those are very far-fetched methods, but certainly the argument that application of the statute would violate due process or the right to a fair and impartial jury is an argument that could have been made by trial counsel. We would probably run into the prejudice issue, whether or not that would have been successful or not. Might be a Strickland prejudice issue. Finally, possible challenges to the statute. But initially, you're right. The prosecutor may have consented, and it wouldn't be an issue.
Do the allegations support a reasonable inference that had the waiver been effected, had the case been tried to the judge, the outcome would have been different?
Well, again, as I pointed out in my reply, with the standard has been clarified in Porter versus McCollum about the confidence in the result as really what we're looking at. And yes, I think absolutely. In a case like this.
That's really not news. I thought in Strickland, in those cases talked about, it's not more likely than not. It really is the undermining of our confidence.
Yes, but it's nice to see that reaffirmed when we've all gotten so used to saying you have to prove the result would be different. We've grown accustomed to it. But to answer your question, I think that the some of the issues in this case that also link in with the ineffective assistance were the venue issues. This was the front page cover of Westward. This was the poster child for the failure of the restraining order system. The fact that the sound system ended up not working, the jury complained they couldn't hear the witness, which happened to be my client. The judge apparently did hear him correctly, and I outlined this in the brief. So something that doesn't arise in every case, but the fact that the judge could hear it. The fact that judges may not be, the judge knew, for example, that the attempted murder charge against Mr. Rice had been dismissed. The jury hears that Mr. Garrett attempted to kill Mr. Rice. Well, that had been dismissed for lack of evidence. So I think there's a very reasonable inference, and we don't know. This was an exceptionally close case. It was an ugly case. But it was very close. There's one witness who had all kinds of problems with him. This Mr. Rice, or Mr. Garrett didn't even see in the garage. We know from the evidence, it's fair to say, that Mr. Garrett's gun killed CR. But whether she was pointing a gun, whether she was holding a gun, that's what was close about this case. And I don't think we can assume on this record, without an evidentiary hearing, without even assigning it to an attorney, if this petition doesn't get assignment of counsel and a hearing, what petition does? I'd like to reserve my scant time for rebuttal. Thank you. Unless there's another question. May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. First of all, I would like to say this was not a very close case. The evidence in this case was that the defendant threatened to kill his wife if she ever left him. He repeatedly threatened to kill her after she left him. He repeatedly violated the restraining order she had against him, and then he shows up in her garage in the middle of the night and shoots and kills her. According to the defendant, the eyewitness, Larry Rice, was not even there. But Mr. Rice testified what he saw. He saw the defendant, he saw the victim's eyes get real big, the defendant coming up the driveway, shot and killed her. After the crime, the defendant spoke to his cousin and said, I shot and killed that bitch because she took my Jeep and she wouldn't let me see my kids. So I don't think this was a case where there was close evidence. And I'd like to just go through some of the specific things counsel mentioned. Thing about the change of venue. According to my record sites, they did ask for a change of venue and the trial court denied it. As to the not asking for a waiver.
Where did they ask for it and where did they deny it?
This is my record sites from my opening brief on direct appeal. I have volume 3, 72803 at pages 4 to 7 is what I cite to that because that issue was raised on direct appeal. As to the waiver of the right to jury trial, as this court mentioned, the prosecutor would have had to have agreed to that. And the defendant's allegations in his 35C motion said nothing about that, said nothing about the probability of the trial court actually granting that motion. He just said counsel was ineffective for failing to pursue my motion for a court trial. Most of the other allegations were just very vague and unspecific. He never really explained why something amounted to ineffective or deficient performance or how he was prejudiced. For example, he says things like, and all of them had to do with things that could have been raised on direct appeal. Some of them were very unclear, as things like failing to object to certain statements the prosecutor made during closing arguments. Failure to investigate, where he didn't specify who the witnesses would have been or what investigation the trial counsel should have done.
How specific does a indigent or a pro se defendant have to be with respect to these allegations in a post-conviction motion?
Fairly specific enough that you can sort of get a sense of what he's talking about. Do you need a hearing on this? Is there something conflicting in the record? He said, for example, refused to subpoena witnesses that the defendant wished to testify on his behalf. And the Chambers case makes clear you have to identify that those witnesses, whether they would have been amenable to process, the substance of the testimony. I'm just kind of going through some of these allegations. Failed to provide competent representation and engaged in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. These allegations are just too vague to warrant an evidentiary hearing.
So I realize that I'm asking you a question that's going to be a little bit unfair because you, like your colleague here, are just left with handling the appeal that you've inherited.
Yes.
But doesn't it seem odd that structurally the resources spent to hire a lawyer in this case, it's odd that they were spent at the appellate level instead of appointing counsel at the trial level, because it seems that so much of this case is going to turn on the sufficiency of allegations made by a pro se defendant. If there's any merit in this case, it would be lost sort of in the pleading requirements. Can you respond to that? And do you know whether this is the kind of thing that's happening regularly in the system?
I don't know that this is the kind of thing that's happening regularly, but I think the same reasons why these allegations fail on appeal, they fail under the standards required to appoint post-conviction counsel, because they are so vague and unspecific. There's nothing here that would alert the trial court to say, maybe there was a problem here. Specifically, since many of these allegations in support of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim go to things that were actually considered on direct appeal, things about evidentiary rulings and prosecutorial misconduct and that kind of thing. There is nothing here specific enough that either failed as a matter of law or some of them were refuted by the record, but most of them were just so vague and unspecific that they didn't even meet the Strickland test. They didn't say how this was deficient or how I was prejudiced. He just wrote a lot of things about what he thought counsel did wrong.
So your view would be that really at no time should counsel have been appointed?
Correct, Your Honor.
Because is the alternative that counsel should always be appointed?
No. If counsel were always appointed, trial courts would do probably nothing but 35C hearings all day if we had counsel appointed, and the amount of resources that would go to this. What the rule says is if the court's not going to summarily deny a motion, then the court should send it over to the public defender to review. And I have seen cases where the court has appointed counsel where the allegations were, if you read them a certain way, perhaps there was a legitimate claim here. And this is not one of those cases. I would be happy to answer any questions the court might have. I'd ask that this court affirm the trial court's order. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. The last two of these, in fact, I think this is the first time I've asked for an oral argument on these cases where an evidentiary hearing isn't granted below. But I know in the last two I had, the district court was reversed, and I didn't even come for an oral argument. And in neither one of those cases was counsel appointed at the district court level. And so we do have a pattern, I think a pretty strong pattern, where the district court is doing a pro forma answer with this kind of boilerplate language months and months and months after the motion, the supplements have been filed. They don't appoint counsel. Nobody screens. Nobody sees what witnesses they would have been. Nobody has an opportunity to present claims in here as they should be presented. That would not be the case if the person were indigent. They would have had a lawyer like, you know, from the get-go, or a death penalty case where they get everything, and then you have a case like this, and then they appoint us on appeal. It happens again and again and again, and that's why I requested oral argument. Because you look at this order, and that's what this appeal is supposed to be about, whether or not this order doesn't say his allegations weren't specific enough. It says he didn't produce evidence, which he can't do until we have an evidentiary hearing. So please, take a stand on this. Remind the trial courts that we all, even the federal courts, depend on them just having the evidentiary hearing, assigning counsel, and being done with it.
Thank you, counsel. Well, thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you. Bailiff will announce a recess.
All right.